Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Hard to find a more iconic Chicago movie than The Blues Brothers. John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd's wild ride through Chicago and the suburbs is still considered a comedy classic. Think you know everything that there is to know about Jake and Elwood and the locations in the 1980 film? Well, grab your dark sunglasses and black fedora, because our next guest has written the ultimate tribute to the cult classic. I sat down with Daniel Devizet to talk about his new book, The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and the making of an American film classic. Daniel starts with why he wanted to explore this now.
Well, it's my fifth book, and with all of my books, I've tried to do stuff I haven't gotten to do as a reporter. I've been a reporter on and off for 30 years, but never got to write about music or film or television. And so I think three of my books are about those things. So it's been a wonderful way to kind of pursue some passions that I haven't gotten to pursue in sort of 9-to-5 work.
That's a great plan. You grew up on Chicago's South Side, right?
Well, I was born there and lived there in South Shore until I was about 5 or 6. We moved to Lincoln Park then, which was a recovering neighborhood at the time. It was there was a head shop around the corner. And my mother and I lived in like 15 different addresses around the city. My father, luckily, was more or less in one place, which was near the Paulina L stop.
I see. Well, I mean, even your journey throughout the Chicago area, I mean, did this movie then hold a special place in your heart?
Oh, yeah. I went to Lincoln Park High School in the first half of the 80s. And, you know, given my age, I was super into all the John Landis films, Kentucky Fried Movie and The American Werewolf in London and Trading Places and such. But yeah, the Blues Brothers was Chicago. And if you think back then, there weren't a lot of Chicago movies. The only other one that I could come up with was My Bodyguard, which came out around the same time. And I think that really sad movie.
Which one?
not Real People. Ordinary People.
Oh, okay.
And there was others. But, you know, Chicago had been a dead zone for cinema for a bunch of years before that. So it was like Chicago was reemerging for film. And yeah, it was a huge deal to have this big Chicago Valentine that I could go and watch.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and to that end, for those who don't know the story, Daniel, how did this movie end up being set in Chicago?
Well, that's because Dan Aykroyd, who conceived the story and wrote the first iteration of the script, loved Chicago. He was from Ottawa, but he was a big blues hound. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Canadians love Chicago, I think, generally.
I can speak to that.
Okay. And he loved Belushi. Belushi was, at that point, his bestie, and Belushi was from Chicago. And so Aykroyd wrote this movie partly in honor of his friend John Belushi, and as a Valentine, again, to the city and to the blues scene in Chicago. Ah. So it was always, I think, going to be set in Chicago.
Yeah. Well, probably one of the most memorable scenes is when their car crashes into Daly Plaza.
Well, this is definitely Lower Wacker Drive. My estimations are correct. We should be very close to the Honorable Richard J. Daly Plaza.
That's where they got that Picasso.
Yep.
There's a story behind that.
Yeah, because it's hard to imagine something like that getting approved today. So you got to tell us.
And it wouldn't have been approved a half decade earlier. So if you go back to that era, Mayor Daley, the first Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, who could never utter a grammatically correct sentence, had shut down Chicago as a filming location. There was a G-Man movie or something in the 50s that portrayed corrupt Chicago cops, I think, and Daley didn't like it. And Daley ran the city, so he shut down filming for, like, I don't know, 20 years.
Oh, wow.
So, but you come to 1979, Mayor Daley had died. Jane Byrne was the mayor. She was getting, I think, a lot of guff, it's fair to say, from Daley's old cronies, and maybe wasn't all that fond of Mayor Daley's cronies and maybe of his immediate legacy. And so when the idea came forward to her desk that perhaps they could roll a convoy across Daily Plaza.
She said, why not?
Sure. Sure thing.
Oh, my goodness. Car crashes are a huge part of this movie, though. I mean, they happen throughout. Yeah. The filmmakers apparently purchased 60 retired squad cars to be used in the film. And I'm hearing that the movie actually holds the record for the most cars destroyed in a film.
But you're right. They really only numbered 60, I think, and they rebuilt a bunch of them. So some cars were destroyed twice. They had a shop out west of the Loop, and they would roll the remains of the cars out there and repair them and then put them back into action in a subsequent scene.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, because I hear that the most the record is 103.
Is that right?
For the number of cars destroyed. But you're right.
It's more than 60.
If some of these are getting destroyed twice.
Twice. Maybe three times.
There we go, right? What else can you tell us about some of the crazy car stunts?
Well, the thing that really impresses me is how they pulled off this thing inside the mall. There was this dead mall, Dixie Square Mall, in the southwest suburbs. And it was kind of an amazing coup. They found a dead mall in 1979 because malls were very much alive then. But they found one. And they shot this just mayhem scene where they kind of rebuilt the mall with like RJ Grunts and Jewel Foods and all these Chicago names inside. Mm-hmm. And then they destroyed it again, with these cars rampaging through the mall for multiple days. And if you could picture this, it's supposed to be a nighttime scene, right? Because it's at night.
Right.
They burst into the Miss Piggy thing, and they crash into the mall, and it's nighttime. So they had to black out all of the windows and the doors so no light could get in. And then the place is probably filling up with exhaust fumes, because these are leaded gasoline. And there was also rotting produce in the Jewel Food Store, because it just sat there for days. So they would periodically come out and take breaks just to breathe in clean air. That's kind of my funny story about the stunt driving.
My goodness.
And then the other thing is, there's no CGI in 1979.
Right, of course not.
So the cars were like, they would have like a rut in the side of the road. And that scene where Elwood says, you want to exit? Okay, we'll exit. And he pulls off the road and like down the embankment. They had to dig a huge ditch in there so the cars would sort of tumble.
Oh my
side
goodness.
Over side and end over end.
It was so much more involved.
Real.
Yes.
And stunt drivers. And the same thing, the scene under the L tracks, which is another colossal pileup. There too, they had like this Australian, probably Mad Max stunt technology that like catapulted the cars on top of each other.
Oh,
and it's
my goodness.
Very impressive. I think Roger Ebert, sometimes made the point that, you know, cinema goers had seldom seen the like. It was a really spectacular series of crashes.
Wow. That's incredible. So you share something in common with Dan Aykroyd and the late John Belushi. I'm talking about the love of blues.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I grew up here to my early 20s. I think the first show I ever saw was probably Albert Collins with Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I don't know who was opening for whom. Now, I wasn't the most studious blues hound, certainly not like Aykroyd. But I loved the blues, and I set out to write a B.B. King biography several years ago.
You did, yes.
And spent years on that.
Yeah. So where did your fondness for the music come from, you think?
Well, I'm a lifelong music person. I played in the band in Linkin Park and played in cover bands later on. And just I've always loved music and always wanted to do a music book.
Mm-hmm.
And being from Chicago and being stunned there wasn't a literary biography of B.B. King anytime in the recent past, I set out to write one. And that became this book. And at one point, I reached out to John Landis, the director of the Blues Brothers.
Right.
And I wanted to know why B.B. King hadn't been in the Blues Brothers, which is a good question, right? He's the king of the blues.
That is true.
And it's the Blues Brothers. And so he explained that B.B. King, almost alone out of these great rhythm and blues artists, was actually really busy. And just his manager didn't make time in his schedule to do it. Now, B.B. was very upset about this many years later.
Did he know who else was going to be in there?
Well, later on, he found out, and he was crushed.
Out.
But Landis got to telling me, he's like, well, you know, this is John Landis talking, you know, this the real mission from God. I'm not doing a very good John Landis voice. And I said, well, do tell, you know. Because in the movie, the mission from God, of course, is to raise $5,000 to pay a tax bill for an orphanage, which is a Catholic orphanage, which doesn't make sense. Chicago Catholic orphanages did not pay tax bills then or now. But the real mission from God, I was told, back, this is like 4 years ago, was that Aykroyd and Belushi and Landis wanted to do their part to sort of shine the light on their heroes, the great icons of rhythm and blues, who, if you can paraphrase the Steely Dan song, you know, hard times had befallen the sole survivors. At the close of the 70s, you had your disco, burning out at Comiskey. You had your arena rock, and just all of that meant that the great icons of rhythm and blues from the 50s and 60s had fallen on hard times.
Well, to that end, let's listen to Aretha Franklin.
Now, you listen to me. I love you, but I'm the man and you are the woman, and I'll make the decision concerning my life.
You better think about what you're saying. You better think about the consequences of your actions.
Oh, shut up, woman.
You better think.
There were also appearances by James Brown, Ray Charles, Johnny Lee Hooker. I mean, how hard was it for filmmakers to get all of those legends to participate back then?
Well, we talked about Beebe. They got most of who they wanted. They tried to get Muddy Waters, who I would argue is probably was the greatest Chicago blues man of that era. And he agreed, but then he fell ill right before shooting. But they got everybody else, I guess. And I want to say that Ray Charles, James Brown, Aretha Franklin, for the most part, Cab Calloway, John Lee Hooker were, you know, happy to be in the film. I think they understood that the goal of the filmmakers was to showcase them and to make this crazy sort of car crash action comedy slash musical.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think Aretha Franklin had some misgivings because she was being cast, I think, in her mind as kind of like a waitress, which I don't think she thought much of that. But I think once she showed up on the soundstage in Hollywood and saw this amazing recreation of the diner, I mean, big, big budget. And
she said, okay, I'll do it.
And Landis would be very quick to point out she was actually cast as the owner of the diner and very much the person in charge of Matt Guitar Murphy.
Well, for sure.
And of the diner. So, you know, but anyway, so they all were very happy with it in the end, I think.
Let's go back to the beginning. As many know that the movie starts at Joliet Prison, but you, in your book, you shed light on some stories about the shoot that weren't publicized, right?
Well, there's a bunch of them. And some of these are known by some people out there, but just to start with, in terms of narrative tension for my story, Belushi almost died.
On set.
During the shoot, this would be the final weeks, days of the Chicago shoot, late October 1979, he was on a serious drug bender. He had a very serious substance problem. And in those final days in Chicago, according to Landis, he had to be pretty much revived a couple of times. I'm talking about breaking down the hotel door and reviving him after a very serious overdose.
From an overdose.
Twice. Wow. So that's a big one. A smaller one, which is fun if you want to go watch the movie again, is if you watch the Ray Charles scene in the pawn shop.
Excuse me, I don't think there's anything wrong with the action on this piano.
Well, I heard about the fella you've been dancing with.
The guys, the horn section, are doing something in the background on the glass display case. Well, what they were doing was pretending to cut up lines of coke. As a joke, because they thought that was funny. And then at some point, Mr. Fabulous, Alan Rubin, I think was his name, the trumpeter, pulls out actual cocaine, and they actually poured it out and actually cut it up. And then Landis yells cut, and they stopped filming, and they didn't film that, I don't think.
Right.
But so if you look...
But some of that almost got them in trouble, right? And jailed.
Oh, well, okay, Joliet Prison, you're right, good memory. A few of the members of the crew were carrying... cannabis, I think, which would be okay now, maybe.
Not back then.
Not then. And so they had to do some sweet talking to get the, you know, the warden to let him off. And another good story is later on, that very same warden of Joliet Prison is at this kind of speakeasy with the boys, and someone passes him a film canister filled with weed.
Wow.
So this is the warden holding a canister of weed. He just gallantly passed it on.
Wow. But I mean, speaking to your mention there of Belushi's fame, you know, he's at the height of his fame at the time. He was being mobbed by people who wanted his autograph wherever he went. So they came up with a pretty unique way to have fun while they were in town shooting. So tell us about the 6-month lease that they took out on that closed bar and turned it sort of into a private club.
Yeah. Gosh, there's several things to unpack here. Belushi had been a star of Second City in Chicago in the early 70s, so he was known here even before he got famous. So when he came back, it was like his own fame but on steroids, because now he was triply, quadruply famous because of Animal House and Saturday Night Live.
Right.
He was like the nocturnal mayor of Chicago in those months. Now, he and Aykroyd had had a series of speakeasies. They had one in New York for after parties for SNL,
mm-hmm.
and then they requisitioned one across from Second City, which was, I think, it became called the Blues Bar, you know, Mach 2 or Mach 3, and they partied there by night.
Oh, my goodness. You know, as the title implies, the movie is also the story of the friendship, right?
Very much. It's a dual biography. I mean, I don't do hundreds of pages on Belushi or on Aykroyd, but enough that I want you to understand when the reader gets to the Blues Brothers to understand why they mattered,
yeah,
and why this friendship was so powerful and where it all came from, you know? And so I feel like you need to know Second City and you need to know SNL,
right?
And you need to know Lorne Michaels and you need to know where these boys came from.
And all of that is the rise of improv,
yeah,
portion
the first
of
half
your title.
Of the book, basically.
Yeah. So, I mean, all these crazy stories, and leave us with your closing thoughts then on just the legacy of this classic film in Chicago's history and culture.
I read a great quote from a local musician, so I can't take credit for this, but it feels right that if you're from Chicago and you're rich, or maybe you're from like the John Hughes North Suburbs, then Ferris Bueller is your film. But if you're from Chicago and you're poor, or you're from the city, the actual city,
yeah,
then it's more the Blues Brothers, and that feels right to me.
That's Daniel Devizet, author of The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and the Making of an American Film Classic. It's out now, and you can find it wherever books are sold. Such a fun read. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman and mixed and edited by Meha Ahmed. To hear more conversations about culture, food, music, and Chicago area news, make sure to subscribe and head over to wbez.org/reset for a full archive of our interviews. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk again soon.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.